Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk more about war correspondence and the First World War and the development of the role of the war correspondent, which is an entirely modern phenomenon. For example, people like William Howard Russell during the Crimean War, and indeed Winston Churchill during the Boer War. War correspondents were good business as far as newspaper editors were concerned. They brought a constant stream of exciting news stories to the domestic population. I'm talking particularly in Britain here, but obviously that there are parallels in other European countries and the United States, and generally countries where there were high levels of mass literacy, cheap printing, and a need for a constant slew of news reporting. The yellow press in America of Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst made immense profits from tales of the Spanish-American War in Cuba and the Philippines. The war correspondent as propagandist is really a beast of the First World War. Not that the war correspondent didn't do essential propaganda roles during the Crimean and Boer Wars and didn't have deep-held biases towards their own side, which inevitably they did do, and present the British as either the heroic victors or the persecuted victims. Whereas the picture's normally obviously far more complicated and nuanced and subtle than that. But it wasn't systematic. There was no Ministry of Information. Instead, generals seemed to have to put up with these rather irritating characters who were stopping them from or interfering with or just a general encumbrance on their job as military commander. I think part of the attraction of war writing in the British press is because before the First World War, when the British Army was a small and professionalised corps of career soldiers and not a mass conscript army, the involvement with warfare and the risks associated with it was concentrated to a tiny, tiny portion of the population. Everybody else tended to hear about this secondhand. Also, none of the wars fought, such as the Opium Wars or the Boer War or the Crimean War, were wars of national survival. These were imperialist wars about establishing Britain's hegemony in Asia, Africa, and over the Near East. So there was something very attractive about these kinds of narratives, and they obviously feed into this sense of exceptionalism, of racial supremacy, and of British nationalism in the 19th century. Whereas First World War reporting was going to be quite a different phenomenon altogether. Lord Kitchener, who had first-hand experience of war reporters in Sudan, where he destroyed the Mahdi movement, he loathed them and didn't want them anywhere near the British Expeditionary Force in France. The core of the Expeditionary Force, the BEF's officers, agreed and didn't really want to have correspondence from the Daily Mail and the Times hovering around. They think that they were general nuisance and were likely to get killed. The strategy dreamt up by Lord Northcliffe of the Daily Mail was to send somebody that the officers would consider a gentleman, a sportsman, someone who knew about, say, riding and who could keep up with them on horseback. And the kind of person who would be invited to the officers' club. So the sporting editor of the Daily Mail was sent to buy a horse and was sent to the War Office to report. To which the War Office responded that there were no immediate plans to give war correspondents accreditation. And the Times also found that they were shut out as well. So the biggest newspapers in Britain found themselves without correspondents in Europe at the outbreak of war. And instead they had to rely on a very dry daily communique from the army from Paris. And these were also wildly misleading. The official write-ups sent to the press were approved by generals and were there to help protect their careers and help to protect their egos. As they would later find out, generals like French and Rawlinson and Haig were actually quite well taken care of by the press. When the shell crisis of 1915 emerged, where it turned out that Britain was ill-prepared for war and didn't have enough artillery shells for the kind of heavy anti-trench bombardments that were defining the war, the newspapers turned on the government and took the heat out of any criticism of the generals themselves. The war reporting on the Eastern Front was an entirely different story. The Russians had very few correspondents, and those that they had were not allowed anywhere near the front line. The Russian people seemed particularly poorly informed about the progress of the war, and it's really soldiers returning and telling horror stories about the front that begin to disseminate these ideas in Russian society. Germany imposed complete military censorship from the start of the war, and there were no German war correspondents allowed anywhere near the front. And all news was sent home via a twice-weekly press conference from the German general headquarters. As Philip Knightley reports, one of the general rules that the German officer who would stand in front of the press had to abide by was that it is not so much the accuracy of the news as its effect that matters. Now, this all seems highly undemocratic and closed and disingenuous, but it was a system that was very much adhered to by the British. If you listened to the previous podcast I did about the wartime Ministry of Information, except the British just did it differently. They did it in cooperation with newspapers who colluded in a misleading version of the war to the general public. The German War Office, the Kriegspressamt, which was controlled by the general staff, offered its own periodicals and booklets and pamphlets, and it organised also censorship. And officer correspondents within the army would provide information in terms of military reports to the Kriegspressamt who would then disseminate it. So it neatly cut the commercial press out of the whole operation. Again, the British view of the dissemination of information was not entirely dissimilar. And the British General Staff took the lead on this. Censorship, obviously, the Defence of the Realm Act was imposed on August the 2nd, 1914, and the appointment by Kitchener of Colonel Sir Ernest Swinton to the staff, or the general staff of the Commander-in-Chief, to write reports on the progress of the war was Kitchener's only real concession towards any kind of openness. But these were again wildly misleading. And misleading not because they told direct lies, but because they omitted most important information. So generally the role that Swinton saw he had was to avoid helping the enemy, to mislead the enemy where possible, and to tell the public only as much of the truth as he thought that the general public were prepared to deal with. So in 1914, for example, in September the 18th, 1914, Swinton reported on the conditions in the trenches on the Aisne. And he said, "It may be said that along the greater part of our front, the Germans have been driven back from their forward slopes on the north of the river. Their infantry are holding the strong lines of trenches amongst and along the edges of the numerous woods which crown these slopes. The trenches are elaborately constructed, where our men are holding the forward edges of the high ground on the north side. They are now strongly entrenched. They are well fed, and in spite of the wet weather of the past week, are cheerful and confident." Again, the lack of any kind of meaningful detail and sort of bland generalisations was a skillful way of trying to control the flow of information. Editors became quickly frustrated and they looked to Churchill, at the First Lord of the Admiralty, to do something about all of this. And Churchill, a former war correspondent, again was pretty inflexible, as Kitchener was. And so most war correspondents, most newspapers, hired war correspondents to get round this problem and to be unofficial and not, as we would call it now, embedded reporters. A succession of kind of chancers and adventurers, men who had experienced war before, either as combatants or previous correspondents, or who were these kinds of rather hair-raising figures that you find in and around the periphery of conflict, were hired by Fleet Street to go out to Europe. One of the first was Granville Fortescue. He was an American freelance journalist who'd been in the White House. He'd been a White House aide in Washington, a military observer in the Russo-Japanese War, an explorer in Venezuela, and a war correspondent in Morocco. For the Standard newspaper, the Evening Standard, and during the start of the First World War,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
He had been in Belgium and headed to London, sent his family to London, and sent a telegram to the Daily Telegraph saying, I'm ready for action and ready for service. What do you think? When he got no response, he finally filed a story, the greatest scoop of his career, on August the 3rd, that German troops had invaded Belgium, and it was the front page story on the Daily Telegraph. The headline being, Country Invaded by German Troops, from our own correspondent. This scoop landed him a job as a roving war correspondent, and it meant that other British newspapers began to race to Europe and began to send as many stringers and correspondents as they could to Europe to try to catch up with this extraordinary exclusive. So what this shows us is war reporting was obviously a product of the rivalry and the competitiveness of the newspaper industry itself, which didn't stop attempting to make a profit simply because a war of national significance, national survival, some might argue, had begun on the continent. Kitchener, irritated by all this, demanded that any correspondent found in France be arrested, on the front, be arrested, have their passport confiscated, and be expelled back to England or wherever they came from. And there were attempts by correspondents to get round this, to get the exclusive. The Times man in Paris organised a group of what he called keen young men to travel behind Allied lines, and they were instructed, be as inconspicuous as possible, go over the ground by train to a certain point, then by bicycle or on foot. The principal thing is to keep rigidly away from the English, who take a fiendish delight in arresting war correspondents. The writing that they compiled, the information they compiled, was then couriered back to London in a complicated system of relays of cars and trains between Paris and Boulogne, and then Folkestone and London on the other side of the Channel. The Daily Chronicle sent Philip Gibbs to France. He had started his career on a smaller newspaper, the Daily Graphic. And his job for them as a sketch artist had been to go to Serbia and to go up and down the front line, drawing images and sending those back to London. Philip Knightley reports what he had to say. It's very interesting. He said he had an immeasurable ignorance of the meaning of warfare. I knew nothing about its methods and its machinery, the immensity and range of its destruction. I thought it would be like the South African affair, remote, picturesque, and romantic. He said that the crown of the journalistic ambition, the heart of its adventure and romance, was covering war. And if you look at correspondence in the Second World War, you find remarkably similar sentiments coming forth. Ideas that this was the pinnacle of journalism, that this was the top of the tree. But also you have this naivety, and it's a naivety that is understandable, because journalists weren't just the only ones that were naive about the level of destruction that would result from this conflict. Most of the writing that appeared in British newspapers was about the Western Front. So, for example, one of the most significant events of the war, the destruction of the Russian army at the Battle of Tannenberg and the Masurian Lakes in August 1914, is virtually unknown in Britain and also in France. The focus on the Western Front, which has continued long after the war, and really it still shapes the British conception of what the First World War was only becomes really a very negative focus after the Battle of the Somme in 1916. Kitchener continued in 1915 to wage his private war against war correspondents without being able to really see what use that they might possibly have, which it later turns out to be of considerable use. The short-sightedness of this is clear when you understand that the Defence of the Realm Act had the government and the army covered anyway, that newspapers were obliged to publish really what the government wanted, and so censorship was laid down in law, voted through by Parliament without any problem. And help came from a rather unlikely source. There were a large number of American war correspondents who were writing or wished to write for British newspapers and were either arrested by the British Army or sent back to Britain or sent back to America. And when the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, received a letter from former President Theodore Roosevelt, who was an enthusiast for Britain in the war and thought that America should perhaps intervene somehow. Roosevelt said to Grey that the practice of banning war correspondents, particularly American war correspondents, was preventing information from getting to an American audience, and it was harming Britain's standing with the American population. The hope that America might enter the war was a very real and very significant one amongst the British government, who by 1916 were bankrupted by the war. And anything that could be used to sway American popular opinion was an enormous benefit. German military authorities by this point had changed their mind and had started to lavish enormous attention on American war correspondents. The German government didn't think for a moment that America was likely to join the war on Germany's side, but they certainly thought that American popular opinion, if it was more favourable towards Germany, might be less likely to join a war against Germany. Roosevelt wrote, "There has been a very striking contrast between the lavish attention showered on war correspondents by the German military authorities and the point-blank refusal to have anything to do with them by the British and French governments. The only real war news written by Americans who are known to and trusted by the American public comes from the German side. If you think American public opinion should be taken into account, then it is worth your while considering whether much of your censorship work and much of your refusal to allow correspondence at the front has not been a danger to your cause from the standpoint of the effect on public opinion without any corresponding military gains." So the gradual trickle of correspondence to the front line began. But when asked, for example, how much of the war they should cover and what they should be allowed to say, General Charteris, Chief of Intelligence, said to one correspondent, "Say what you like, old man, but don't mention any places or people," which rather invalidated the whole process. The new group of war correspondents were all given an honorary status as captains, so they were officers, and had a green band on their right arm. They were given officers' uniforms, but without badges or insignia. And they were holed up in the same house, a small house in the village of Tattingen, as their headquarters, and provided with all sorts of things that they need: orderlies, lorries, cars, and the military chaperones to make sure they didn't get killed, and to take them to places that the general staff found useful, but perhaps not places that the correspondents wanted to go. However, this kind of management was still a significant step forward from the sort of harassment that they'd faced from Kitchener previously. Kitchener's death on the high seas might well have been one of the things that sort of greases the wheels ever so slightly. And the military chaperone that they were given, named the conducting officer, were generally instructed by headquarters to waste the journalists' time as much as possible and to show them as little of use as possible. Now, here you see a tension between the general staff of the British Army and the government itself. The generals saw themselves as really the king's generals, not the cabinet's generals, and they saw themselves certainly not answerable to a little lower class upstart like David Lloyd George. Instead, they thought that the conduct of the war was not a civilian business, and the idea that they were the representatives of a mass democracy, a mass parliamentary democracy, and had to really abide by what an elected government told them to do, was almost completely completely lost on them. So much so that generals like French communicated directly with the king when they had something that they had a bee in their bonnet about over Parliament. And there was this enormous showdowns eventually between Lloyd George and Kitchener. So the idea that they should be encumbered with journalists, even though it was clearly a good idea and clearly something that the war cabinet wanted, was robustly defended and ignored and sidelined. And much of this, I suspect, has got to do more with social class and about the operating of entrenched elites than it has got to do about military efficacy. Anyway, we're going to continue with this one a little more and hopefully talk about the disaster at Gallipoli and how that's covered. And we will look at the works of Sir Keith Murdoch, father to the Dark Lord himself, and we'll chat about that next time. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm going to put a link in the podcast blurb below if you want to support us on Patreon. And also, if you can, go to the iTunes page, give us a nice write-up, a thumbs up, a five-star review if you can, and that's all to the good. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.